Hello, I'm GW. Daniel is with me online as always. Today he will be talking to Dr. Christian Lintner, the author of two prominent books, Master of Wisdom, which is a standard text used in comparative religion, and also a new one titled The Revelation of Bodhicitta, which we will be talking about. He is a scholar of Sanskrit, Buddhism, and comparative religion. He has taught at Copenhagen University, at the University of Virginia, and at Washington State University in Seattle. Today we'll be talking about Holocaust denial, on the malign effects of the 68ers, and new discoveries and research into Christianity's fundamental scripture, which is the New Testament. Daniel.
Hello, Dr. Lintner. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today, and welcome to MR Radio. I thought it might be a good place to begin to talk about your experiences of the 68ers and their pejorative influence on academic standards.
Okay. I was born in 49 and went to the university, started taking up classics, Greek and Latin, eventually went on to Sanskrit, and I was there in 68 and 69, poking my nose deeply into these into ancient history based on the study of languages. And there I had the chance to experience what sort of changes took place. Two different worlds met. There were still the old professors. Some of them were rather degenerate. New times came in with the student revolt. And how could one characterize it? Slogan was more equality. And all basically, we are all equal. And it is a damn lie that some people are different in terms of character and in terms of knowledge. Isn't it unfair that students don't have as much to say and decide as the old corrupt professors? That sort of was the general spirit.
So where this comes to bear first on our concerns is that you found some rigorous scholars, German scholars, studying the Holocaust, and this gave way to lax standards in subsequent generations.
Well, the point I wanted to make was this, that there were increasingly few really qualified scholars of the old generation. And the general idea would be it's better to have four or five rather poorly qualified people than one fully qualified professor. Yes. But since I represented such an ancient discipline as Sanskrit studies, the 68ers really didn't come much into the picture here because they didn't take up these difficult issues. Mm-hmm. They were typical psychologists, pedagogues.
The humanities.
What is unfortunately called your humanities, yes. But my contacts were still the old-timers, especially abroad or in Belgium, in Germany, and elsewhere. So I didn't suffer so much personally. But eventually in 82, when I became a doctor of Sanskrit and Buddhism, the weaklings, Marxists, or if you wish, barbarians, they decided we don't want these ancient studies anymore. And then the professorships of ancient Iranian and ancient India, that is Sanskrit, and other similar professorships were abandoned. I was fortunate personally to get a position then in the United States, but it became increasingly difficult to survive as a Sanskrit scholar. But I personally made it and continued publishing. But the standards were now very, very low.
Can I just ask one question?
Sure.
I'm quite interested to...
I almost said that.
I also belong to this... I'm just on the edge of the 68 generation. I was born in 51. Mm-hmm. So I was too young for university at that time anyway. And I was a dreadful rebel. And it's probably a good job that I didn't go to university at that time. The bottom line here is that there has to be some form of study of this phenomenon that came to the fore throughout the 60s and finally blew itself up on the streets of Paris in 68. And I'm just wondering why, having observed this, having experienced it and having rejected it, and having had, as it were, a discipline of your own, which encouraged you to stand aside, to stand on this very ancient solid ground and look at this this fuss, this hullabaloo, perhaps form judgments about it. I'm just wondering how you would characterize its causes, why it existed, why people felt as they did at that time, whether there were understandable reasons about for it underneath, which we can be compassionate about, or whether we just write it off as being the activities of a lot of scurrilous, worthless people.
As I saw it from the Danish side, it may be different from other sides. It was simply, here was an easy way to get a good job.
Well, the student
lower the standards, that's all. Yeah. Nothing more. It's so easy to say, oh, I'm also here. I'm not perhaps so qualified, but still give me a chance. I want a position too. And I don't know the figures, the statistic, but could it be something like 5 times as many as previously? Say in 65, perhaps, we had so-and-so many. And then 15, 20 years later, something like 5 times as many people. Right. You don't have to. So I had to read something like 1,200 pages Sanskrit and 2,000 pages of other Indian languages, and in the end, the requirements were something like 100 pages, which is impossible. Yeah. So that's in a nutshell. It's just making incompetent people competent, but they don't become competent just by getting a degree.
I need to say something about this. I don't dispute what Dr. Lintner is saying about the 68ers in Europe, and there is a Marxist influence there, which has an ethnic component. This also happened around the same time, something similar Marxist-inspired movement in the United States. We had the free speech movement in Berkeley, which was very Marxist, and the civil rights activism, which had Marxist backing, the Yippies, which were a Jewish group. Mm-hmm. But it's very important for me to know, because I did have experience of these people, that there were also that there were also hippies, white hippies, who were honestly concerned to, and justifiably, to rebel against the Vietnam draft, and and concerned with their right to struggle for existence. This is not a trivial issue, but very few of them were concerned with civil rights and the kind of Jewish influences that the right wing is frequently want to associate with hippies, and therefore blame white men for Jewish issues. I just wanted to make that distinction. I'm not here to defend the Marxist influence in the 68ers, but I am here to defend the white men who were rebelling against corporate and war and the habit of war, which didn't have anything to do with their genetic interests. But this is an American thing, and I can understand I can understand how that would be opaque. I can understand how that would be opaque to Europeans. I just wanted to make that caveat. That's not to defend the 68ers.
I suppose if we go to Germany, in Germany there would have been much more violence than we saw in the Danish University in 68. November 68 is the day. There's a very nice picture with the communist rector and the young psychologist who never finished his studies, super red Marxist. But they never contributed in any positive way. They got their positions. And they had their students who are now in charge and are quite as incompetent or confused, if we want to be more nice. Behind it all, of course, were the names of these Jewish intellectuals, Marcuse, Horkheimer, whatever their names. But I wonder how much influence they had. The important thing for the Danes was just to get positions so that we all could become equal. That's the point in the Danish. That's just it. Become equal. The simple peasant could now become equal.
You think that this lack of standards has had implications for Holocaust studies?
It had in the sense that we had no competent Holocaust teachers or scholars in Denmark. We didn't have one single. I was the first who really took it up seriously. I started in a vacuum, and that explains my fortunate or not so fortunate fate in this regard.
You wanted to mention this Sylvia Stoltz case.
Well, it'll be like this. We have to have the broader perspective first.
Okay.
In 1992, I came to know quite incidentally that there were people who denied the very existence of Holocaust. Before that, I had heard the word Holocaust, but never given much thought to it. So I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. Intellectually stimulating, because my own research had always been to seek new sources, to go to India, to have people go for me to Mongolia, to Russia, and find new sources, because my dissertation was presented a lot of new sources I got from various Asiatic countries. So I liked this idea of exploring. Okay, So I also went to the sources in case of the Holocaust thing, and eventually ended up in 1994 with the number one denier, who was professor and is Professor Forestang in Vichy in France. His background was much the same as mine, a professor of Latin and of French literature. It seemed he was very much on the left, not at all a Nazi or something like that. Intellectually, very bright. And he said to me, Dr. Lindner, I have given up my Latin studies, devoted myself to the greatest, biggest lie in history, that of the 6 million Jews. I was very impressed. And he seemed very courageous, sacrificing his own intellectual achievements in order to liberate Europe and the world from the lie of the Jews. That was the situation. I liked that idea. What a hero. That's where I came into this. This was the very year that the very important books on dissecting the Holocaust and the German one, Grundlagen, came out, and Forestang was nice enough to present me with that copy, plus a copy of the entire Sündel case, Did 6 million Really Die? And I read this. Remember, I didn't know anything about, virtually nothing about Holocaust before that. I was very impressed. Intellectually, very stimulating it was. So I came back, and then I just wanted to check out with my colleagues in the history department. Now, what do you people say to this? Here is some news. And they were stupefied and could not give me any answer to my questions. Where's the proof for the gas chambers, I asked them. They could give me no reply. They presented some witnesses who turned out really to be very stupid and had just made it all up. And so I published in the 90s in the major Danish newspaper, Holocaust in a New Light, big scandal. The Danish university invited a German scholar, Jekyllen, who came up here and gave a talk at the university in order to refute me. Okay. And then I met him in the break and introduced myself and said, Professor Jekyll, please explain to me, how can it be that already in 1919, or was it 17, we have an American newspaper mentioning the Holocaust of 6 million? That's fishy, isn't it? And then, instead of replying, he ran away. This act, now I later on see, actually very distinguished and qualified German professor. So he should have taken me and said, Dr. Lindner, there's something you don't understand. Let's sit down, let me explain. But he ran away. And Danish historians publicized then in the newspapers that I was an evil denier. When I met them in the street, I'd say, let's talk. They ran on their two legs. So I felt assured there must be something about this. Then as time passed by, I got more and more trouble in the university, and eventually they managed to kick me out because I was an evil Holocaust denier. Then in 2006, I went to Iran. I had no contacts in Iran, but one day I received a kind invitation from the president, Mr. Ahmadinejad, to come and attend. That was rather fascinating because I'd been to India, but since I also studied ancient Iranian languages, very interesting inscriptions of Persepolis and Behistun, very important for ancient religion. Okay, I said, oh, that's going to be interesting to go to Iran, or to Tehran. And this was announced as a great Holocaust denial conference, denounced, not only announced, but also denounced, if I remember correctly, even by Hillary Clinton. Right. And, well, the politicians in Europe were on the top and on the back of one another in order to denounce these evil deniers. But I was appointed to the committee to see by the president, perhaps we were five members, to seek what was true and what was false in the Holocaust story. And let me add, Mr. Ahmadinejad never denied the Holocaust. I listened very carefully to what he said, but still the mass media were telling, oh, he's an evil Holocaust denier. Okay, I came back home. This was December 2006. And nothing happened for a couple of years. And then I decided we are obliged to do something about this because the president has asked us to do this. And then I set aside, I think, something like 16, 18 months to try to empty my mind and then look at things with fresh eye. I ordered the most recent German books on the issue, some very good ones, and I was in fact quite fortunate that the first volume of a German senator on the Ordnungspolizei, on the German Order Polizei, came into my hands. And when I had read these 2 or 3 months, 1,500 pages or so on, documentations from German cases against policemen that had never come to the knowledge of Danish historians, never ever before. It was clear to me that the Holocaust was anything but a myth. That is, Holocaust defined as the systematic murder of Jews in various ways by the order, from the order of Hitler. So I informed Forrestang before I went public. It was my duty, of course, to report back to Iran. So I informed Forrestang and say, I don't understand this. I read this and this and this. I read all these names, but when I look in your books, I got all the books of Professor Forrestang, there are hundreds of names of perpetrators whom you never mention. I didn't get any answer. I repeated my request, didn't get any answer, or rather evasive answers like, show me the order. And a third time, and I had friends ask Forrestang too. So Forrestang didn't have the courage to answer me. I said, we must have a public debate. No public debate, just show me the order. And then I saw that Forrestang had been deceiving us. He had been fooling us. And it was really only Forrestang one had to take into consideration, because it's important to know that Forrestang, along with Butz, Arthur Butz, they are the main and the most qualified and most intellectual of all the deniers. And Forrestang, there can be no doubt, because Forrestang does say, and that's the proper definition of the denier, that there was no plan, there was no budget, there was no order. And on the positive side, he says, if you ask him, what then was the policy? Forrestang says, to deport the Jews to the eastern areas. Yes, and then? And then we only have one place where he says, what then? And that is in the proceedings of the Sindel case. And he then says, the purpose was, after the war, for the Jews, and I quote, to have kibbutz. So Hitler's policy, according to Forrestang, was that he wanted to take care, also to exploit their powers of labor, to take good care of the Jews so that they could have kibbutz after the war. That is Forrestang's position. And it is utterly unrealistic.
When you're ready, I would like to ask you, though, how you answer to those who bring up the transfer agreement and the fact that there were plans to for Madagascar and
yeah,
so
sure,
on.
Sure. Because we always have to look at it in a chronological perspective. And that is that when Hitler came to power in 1933 and the following years, there were no plans, for the very simple reasons that it, how would they do it? There were no plans to exterminate them physically. But then the great opportunity came in June 1941. And we have so many documents saying, this is our great opportunity, says Hitler. Now we can get away with it without anybody really noticing it. Quite right. Obvious. So of course he didn't kill the Jews in the 30s. That would be stupid. Very, very bad PR. He would have liked to, but he was smart enough to say, we have to have the right opportunity. Of course, of course, of course. And that came with Barbarossa. Obvious. It didn't take more than 3 or 4 days. The first one village after another, right on the border to Lithuania, were completely made Judenfrei. We know the names, the perpetrators, and we have wonderful documentation from the process in Ulm. And we can follow it on the map day by day, day by day. And so I say to Forrestang, what do you say to this? No answer. And I could perhaps squeeze one answer out of him, and that was, oh, these are things that do happen in war, unfortunately. Yeah. But these were not just things that happened in war. These were systematic, day by day. We have many of the contemporary records, like letters from German policemen, writing these, bringing messages back home. Today, we liberated this or that first township in Lithuania, and then later on, working more east, Belarusia, and so on, day by day. We know it all. We know it all. And then Forrestang says, yes, but I don't want to hear about these things. Why not? I only want to hear about the gas chambers. And here you have yet another Forrestang lie. That is, Holocaust is the same as gas chamber. No gas chamber, no Holocaust. So Forrestang, he imposes a definition of Holocaust upon us, which is simply too narrow. And for some time, I was also paralyzed by his demand. In Tehran, you may not know, he arose at the main conference, Forrestang. I admired him at that time. And he said to one of the speakers, give me one proof, just one proof of the Holocaust. And the poor speaker, an Iranian professor, said, but there are many. I don't want many. I want one. So this was a trick, and this was, that's why I used the word chutzpah for this. So we have the situation, and now come, I think we can come to Stolz, that we have Frau Stolz now going to jail for 20 months. We have Frau Haferbeck recently released a video where she says that 6 million were not killed in the gas chambers of Auschwitz. Nobody ever said so. Then we have Bishop Williamson, and I would even say deeply ignorant man, and I would even say Ernst Sündel. These four people, just to mention these, are victims of the highly intellectual and sophisticated Professor Forreston. They are victims. They are hailed, as you said before, among certain nationalists and on the right, as great heroes and heroines. They are not. They are victims.
And Dudonné too.
Who?
Dudonné too.
Oh, yes, of course, because you can see that again and again, Forreston likes to address himself to people who don't know. And he is the French professor who's not a Nazi and looks so orderly. Anybody would think, oh, here we have a real scholar. He is. He knows what scholarship is. But he certainly, there's a misapplication of the academic standards. So it's a very puzzling case. What is then basically wrong with the method of Forreston? It is two things. He ignores the evidence, and if he cannot get away with ignoring, he distorts. That is the basic failure of his method. And that method is the fundamental characteristic of theological method. But then it is this incredible dishonesty where you are willing to let other people be sacrificed. Because that, in a way, I'm sorry to say, is what I find with so many intellectuals in the university. So now you see, there's a line back to 68, and especially with theologians, but that's a separate chapter in a moment. They have much the same as Forreston.
So this straw man of the gas chambers is similar in a way as the straw man of people who say, well, oh, they think the Nazis wanted to take over the world. Nobody thinks the Nazis wanted to take over the world. They were perhaps up to the Urals, but nobody thinks they wanted to take over the world.
Yes, if I understand correctly what you're saying, the gas chambers, it is quite true what Forreston says, that we cannot go down there now and find ruins and so on, but physical evidence that proves it, we cannot find. And so he draws a conclusion, therefore they were not there. That's a false conclusion again, just as the definition of Holocaust is too narrow when he boils it down to the gas chambers. No, things of the past, who in the world can prove that you, Daniel, had a glass of milk in, say, 1988, or a glass of water? I can't prove it, but I'm certain you had something to drink. Mm. Some things disappear into the past. But when Forreston wants us to see the chambers there now, and we can't see them, then he says, they never were there, or prove it to me. So he's again being a trickster. That's why, again, I use chutzpah.
This sort of acting like Jews at their worst, this is all reflecting on European advocacy very badly, to be associated with this stuff, and it's hindering our defense. You seem to think that if we deny these things, we can't compare crimes. We're blocked from then asking the question why. This is what I think. What were the causes of this sort of malice by which we might see mitigating circumstances and begin to absolve certainly subsequent generations sort of guilt.
Yeah, I feel you have two questions there, Daniel. The first one, is this, that how can anyone blame Jews for being mendacious and full of chutzpah when you yourself are a liar? That's a hopeless case. So the only right way to do it is, I think, as Germany has done, is to say, yes, we did this, we have to figure out by way of research and by the way of the law, what actually happened, and we're sorry about that, and to some extent we want to pay reparations, to some extent. This is the only morally proper way to do it. And when you do that, then you are, so to speak, in a position where you can begin on afresh and be decent. So there is a future. Not individual Germans are not to blame, but they would be to blame if they deny. So it's not so difficult, really. If it had been Danes who did these things, I would say, yeah, that's a great pity. I'm a Dane too, and I really regret this. And once I've regretted it with a fairly good conscience, we can go on and say, how can we build up something more positive? That's where we must begin. That's where we must begin. And the Germans can certainly survive. And now they have a good conscience by saying, yes, we admitted crimes of our forefathers. Perhaps we didn't have to. That's an issue in itself. But we have said that's how it happened. And the best research today is being done by German scholars, according to the most objective standards, and so on. Okay, then you can say it's a strange theater now and then with German politicians. I might agree with that. But the basic thing is that they don't lie about the past.
And then you can begin to address not only the crimes of Jewish Bolshevism, but also how the Holocaust has been operationalized as a religion.
That's right.
And taken beyond to where Jewish deaths are made so much more important than European deaths.
Sure. So that part of the picture starts with making it very clear that it was Hitler who ordered this. And it was Himmler and his various branches of police, Ordnungspolizei, Kripo, Grenzpolizei, the Waffen-SS, and so on and so forth, who actually were the perpetrators. And by and large, their crime was that they obeyed orders. That is essentially the problem. They obeyed orders. That is the problem. But you can isolate the problem and then start a philosophical debate. Does one have to obey orders or how? So that is the causality. So next question is to focus on Hitler, because it's really Hitler. Why in the world did he hate the Jews so much? And our sources for coming up with a reply to that question are excellent, mainly his table talk. He says that Judentum is Verbrechertum. Jewishness is to be a criminal. To be a Jew is to be a criminal. That is his view. So we ask, where in the world did Hitler get that view? Okay, that's too much to answer for me, but it's a simple question to be asked, and it's easy to trace it if one does some research. There are roots back to his experiences in Vienna, of course. Then there's his conviction, which is not entirely true, not at all true, that Bolshevism is Jewish. Lots of Jews there, we know that. But if we study, there's so much material now on Stalin himself and the others, like in the KGB and the NKVD. Look at all those people we know who were responsible for Katyn. They're not Jews. There's a recent book by, I forget now, came out in German, very, very carefully done, on the perpetrators of the Katyn massacre on the Polish officers, with pictures on them. Look at the images of these Russian policemen. They look like SS officers, all of them. And then there's perhaps one or two Jews here and there, obviously, but they're secondary in this game. And you remember the remark of Stalin. Was it in the meeting with the foreign minister when the Germans were in Moscow? He says, when the time comes, I'm going to get rid of my Jews. Oh, there's a wonderful book recently in Danish. It's The War of Ivan, and new material from Russia, and very interesting material about how the KGB looked upon the German crimes. A lot of them sympathized with Hitler's Jewish policy of extermination. And by the way, not to lose the thread in any way, the mass graves of the Germans where they had killed the Jews in the East, were first discovered by the Russians in early 42. And it was, Stalin could have used it for propaganda purpose, but for various reasons he didn't do so. But it made the Germans very, very anxious. And so they placed highest priority on getting rid of all traces, exhumating again the graves, burning all the bodies and so on from early 42.
Okay, so you touched upon a philosophical question, which is probably where we have to wrap this up, of the Holocaust up, if we're going to move on to our next discussion, which is of Christianity. Now, you said that there's a philosophical question of the causes of this malice and following orders. And that teasing that apart would seem to be where ultimately we can separate out what was an affectation of German character that got carried away in ideology and provocation, perhaps kicked when they were down in their perception by Versailles. So can you see how there were these extenuating circumstances? They got taken away from their truer selves, and that we can maybe find this innocence again.
As a German, you want me to exonerate. It's complex.
I want to exonerate these generations, subsequent generations, particularly because they had nothing to do with it.
Again, I think it's again like before.
The ones that are dead don't matter.
Try to face the facts. And if we go further back in history, I think it's good to see even the Danish Vikings. As my friend told me the other day, Dr. Lindner, you're behaving exactly like a Danish Viking the other day when you went to Aarhus University, the way you appeared there.
And that's a good analogy. And I guess maybe I'm related to the Romans and Caesar and his Holocaust of the Gauls. And I'm not trying to say that this was a great thing, but neither am I particularly guilty.
No, but it's a good thing to face the facts and then see what can we do. And I mean, when we hear about the Vikings going down there, then suddenly one early morning in northern France, we see those ships coming up there in the horizon. And these strange men with their blonde hair, not very tall, jump on the shore. And a few hours later, all the women and little children are lying like dead Jews on the field, if we can trust the reports. And then eventually they settle down as merchants and other peaceful activities. There is this furor, this German furor. And even, it's seen so often, this German furor, I can still see it. Even in the persecution of deniers in Germany, there is often this fury. So there is something about it. But it's a good thing, Daniel, that we can say there is something about it. What are we going to do? Are we going to laugh? Or are we going to improve ourselves? No. That's a different issue. No. Too much to take up.
Can I just say that if we're looking at this historically, so it becomes extremely tentative to make any absolute or firm conclusions, but nonetheless, let us assume for a moment that there is a certain self-aggrandizing and egoistic character that is associated with some form of German tribalism, yes? That would be roughly along the lines that you're saying, that there's something actually in evolved psyche, in the sociobiology, of the Germanic tribal type that leads to a certain extension or overextension of enthusiasm in the getting, in the getting of aggrandizement, in the superior, victorious, courageous, heroic, and all of these things. This is sort of, mock Nietzschean figure that arrived through fascism, international socialism, all this sort of thing. Well, let's say that this has a certain root. Fair enough. That you can't get rid of.
There is this in the German fiber, but there will also be narratives that play into this. And before we move on to Christianity, I had talked to a Danish guy who was telling me about Vodanism, which sounded to me pretty crazy too. I mean, my understanding of this religion, as a man, you're expected to go to war to be a man, and you're not a man if you don't go to war and put yourself at risk to death and kill people, and you're not going to get a maiden in Valhalla unless you do this, and it sounded totally insane to me. And this is not only some of the ideas that were circulating in the ancient Germanics and the Vikings and so on, but I think that some of the Nazis were beholden to this kind of thinking as well.
Sure, still. Yeah. But the point I'm trying to make,
that war was a part of life. This was a way of life.
Yes. Okay. The point I'm trying to make is that this has positive and negative attributes. One of the positive attributes of it is very much, as I was saying to Tom Sunick last week, that we have this sort of Promethean character as Europeans. We challenge nature, we stand before nature and we tame it. And this creates, through our genius, the modern world that we've been able to give to all humanity. So, you know, there's good and bad that comes out of this. But what you've got to do when you're looking at the bad is to absolutely separate it from any opportunity to ascribe zero value to the other. Racial supremacism is the problem. Where did racial supremacism enter into this event in the arising of Nazis? It didn't come in from fascism. Fascism was not even a racially conscious philosophy in Italy. And it was not so in Romania. That was a Christian philosophy, a Christian version of it. And it didn't come in through, some of it may have come in through Volkishness, but really more of the positive kind, the pride. This negative one, which attaches no value to the rest of mankind, that has only one author. And the author is 2,600 years ago in the past, during the age of the Hebraic troubles in Egypt, and thence after in the destruction of the two temples, and it came down through Talmudism. So that this has always been in the world, this idea that the rest of humanity is separate and other and does not have the same human meaning and the same human value as my tribe, as me, as what belongs to me. And that's the great danger, that if you're going to have people who think war is important, that they do so with a sense of European honor, with a positive sense, and not with this very Hebraic sense that there is no value in those you defeat. We can still have a positive expression, even of a warlike nature, but it always has to be done with honor, as it used to be in the European military tradition, certainly right through to the 19th century in Germany and everywhere else.
This is also going to have a dysgenic effect, as you say, of war, in that people are complaining that European men aren't masculine enough. Well, the most masculine ones have been selected against by this culture of war. They've been killed off.
Well, that war does do that, of course, yes. And you are left with a short-term problem. I mean, regression to the mean and everything, you know, and a lot of that is the character of men is very much a cultural issue as well, isn't it? And that changes with times. Going back to the 68ers, there is a kind of guillotining of the honor and courage, steadfast, cold courage of the wartime generation. And what happened was that this new generation came forward in 1970 in this country. The Birmingham School was Marxized, and they began to churn out people whose function was not academic, whose function was to be trained to march through the institutions to positions of power, to generate this cultural revolution.
All right, so to wrap this up, are we in a position to defend ourselves as Europeans and to defend our right to exist?
Of course. I mean, we have to have this sense of honor and of duty. Perhaps I was thinking of this, how could one, in a simple way, say, what is patriotism? What is nationalism? Because we are dealing with nationalists of various sorts. I would say the root of patriotism and nationalism is a feeling that you are indebted to your forefathers who created a fairly orderly and well-functioning society.
Which is right.
And so that is the ultimate source. And this also has various, if you raise the question about all these third world people, Africans and so on, pouring into Europe, I would handle it in the following way. I would go then down to the border, and when we have 100 black people coming with their rolling white eyes, I would say, very welcome. But before you enter the country, what have you planned to do for your country, for your new country? Why would I ask this question? My late father, who was a royal commissioner, one of the highest officers in Denmark, you had on the wall hanging the well-known saying of Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, but rather what you can do for your country. And that, I think, should be the guiding principle. So we welcome all who are willing. We are coming to Denmark in order to do something for you, and more specifically, what we want to do is this and that. And if they don't have any suggestions, then with a smile, we'll tell them, come back in half
Thank
a year.
You, yeah.
We look forward to what you have and suggest. Then some of them might be missing an arm or lake and so on. And we will be willing, of course, to hospitalize them for the time being so that they can rest in their bed and figure out what they want to do for Denmark. We'd even be willing to consider deporting certain Danes who never, ever understood the idea that they are here for the society, to be useful to society, not to make demands. But our dear friend 68ers, I can tell you that, I never, ever heard one of them think in these terms, that the important thing is what you can do for your country, not what your country can do for you.
And yeah, you're much more liberal, for me you're much more liberal than I am, because I wouldn't even ask this question. I would ask,
no. Oh, sure.
What are your genetics?
Of course you would.
What are your genetics? And then we can talk about where you can live.
Of course you want.
I tell you where we, Daniel and I, would differ with what you, when you're talking about the very root of patriotism and nationalism. It's not particularly, it's a nice idea, but it's not particularly a sense of duty to your fathers. It's a sense of duty to your children. Nationalism, in its true heart, is ethnic, not, I'd say, not really racial. In America, it has to take that form because there is such panmixia amongst the peoples of European descent. But it is really ethnic. And in the end, you could describe it very, very easily and quickly as saying it's the politics of genetic interests. I think that's how we would probably sum it up in a brief time.
I would agree.
I would disagree. I would disagree because my eyes tell me that all those traitors, white traitors, I see around me and behaving in a mean fashion.
Yeah, but I can forgive them because they're a problem for us, but they're still of us.
You can't choose your family.
No, you can't. And we have to obviously prevent them from doing harm, but we also have to cure them with love.
They could be deported too.
Yes, they could be deported too if they had anywhere to go. I'm sure America would be full of traitors from Europe if the opportunity ever arises. But
yeah, it's a traitor.
And the other thing to bear in mind on this, and it is a staggering thing when you're looking at the numbers. I mean, if you look at a society like Sweden, which is undergoing particularly rapid change, and Ireland is gearing up at roughly the same speed and could easily go, you know, into a minoritization very early. Yeah. But we Europeans, generally speaking, have a reproductive fertility rate of about 1.5, which means that every three generations we halve our number. We halve our number in three generations is something like, say, 70 years.
And you really have to take these kinds of things into consideration.
So, I mean, in 70 years' time, there's going to be
citizenship.
Yeah, there's going to be half as many of us. We have to look ahead at what that means. It means that we have to find a way of viewing ourselves, which is not simply through economism. We're not merely an economy. It means we have to find a way of viewing ourselves which is not merely as a culture. We don't really exist as a set of behaviors that anybody can adopt.
And it's not a matter of persecuting others either, but it's a matter of not being obsequious and self-sacrifice.
How will you handle the fact then that there are so many psychologists, pedagogues, theologians, and other no-good-for-nothings?
Well, I handle that by arguing into the ground and telling them, as you said, telling them the truth. The shocking fact to anybody who's had their head filled with the arguments of the 68ers, that these awful people, these nationalists, these disgraceful people who, you know, are blamed every day for being completely morally corrupt and, you know, virtual killers on the loose, happen to be the most moral and intellectually well-founded. The position is intellectually well-founded, more so than any other part of our political zoo on these
issues. So now that we've got GW moving on to a moral debate, this seems to be a good place to move on to Christian Lindner's finding in Revelation to Bodhicitta. How, unlike the 68ers, his rigorous studies of Sanskrit and Buddhism have really come in handy in shedding new light on New Testament studies, on the kind of absurd and divorced from logic, mythical thinking, superimposed through Buddhist sources upon what Dr. Lindner has found is are actually very rigorous Greek texts and thinking. And beginning with the first pope. Is that not right?
That is correct. As said, I started with these Sanskrit studies a very long time ago, almost in the school. And around 1980, I received a book for review, a newly discovered Sanskrit text. And I reviewed it, read the text, of course, first. Okay, some years passed. Then I was reading the New Testament in Greek. And then suddenly something sounded familiar. There was a sentence in the New Testament. You've seen, read this before, haven't you? Where? It took some time because I didn't expect where I had to look, namely in a Sanskrit text, Buddhist Sanskrit text. It was a complete full sentence, translated, same words, same order. And then I started looking again and again. If there's one, there's bound to be more. And little by little, I found scores of examples in the New Testament Gospels, written in Greek, that I could only conclude were translated from the Sanskrit, which meant that there must have been a historical connection for everyone to see who compares the two languages between the New Testament and the Buddhist, also called Gospel, Evangelion, good message in Greek. The Sanskrit is Sutram, good message of the Buddha. And there were the same person, the same characters, not just Jesus, but also the 12 disciples. There are 1,200 in the Buddhist canon. And the same events in the same order taking place, the same teachings. But there was one big difference. There was not a lot of Old Testament in the Buddhist scriptures, but there was in the New Testament. So the idea, little by little, I formed the picture that the 27 books of the New Testament seem to be a very nice mixture of mainly Old Testament stuff, more than 300 quotations, and several hundred quotations from Buddhist texts, thus creating a new clearly fictitious whole, making it quite clear that this, the main character, just like the main apostles and so on, were fictitious because they were made up, they were mosaics. And a mosaic which presents one picture certainly has not a historical person behind himself. It's like if you make a clipping of four American presidents and then use your scissors and then paste them together, you do get one picture behind which there's not one real person of blood and flesh. So that is the conclusion I came to, that we are dealing with copies, very strange copies, because they were not intended to be recognized as such. But in fact, then it turned out that it's not a quite unusual procedure in antiquity. Cicero says of his own philosophical works that they are apocrypha. They are copies of Greek philosophical texts. So it was not actually quite unusual to do such a thing. So I do see New Testament Christianity as Buddhist propaganda. And only last Friday, I served as an opponent ex auditorio at Aarhus University Institute of Advanced Studies, where a Danish theologian defended his thesis on Origen. He's a very important church father, died around 245 or so, extremely prolific, very interesting character. And as I said in my opposition, it will be on the internet soon by Aarhus University. This is really a summary of the Lotus Sutra. What we read in Origen, this great, great church father, had a lot of stuff also from Plato and from the New Testament, is indeed an echo or a copy of the Lotus Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra, check on the internet, is not just any obscure text. Millions and millions of followers even to this day in Japan, and ever since around 250 AD, the Lotus Sutra, when it was first translated into Chinese, has God knows how many million of Chinese followers. It's called the New Testament, There are several English translations. You can easily find them. They're in print, of the Lotus Sutra, or the Lotus of the Wonderful Law. And if you follow them, it's really so close that it's amazing that I'm the first to make the discovery that once you have seen it and check for yourself, read it, and then compare with the New Testament, and you and again have these aha experiences. That sounds familiar. And then you can see how the first disciple of the Buddha, Shariputras, becomes Simon Petrus, how Aniruddhas becomes Andreas, how Maitreyas becomes Messias, and so on and so forth. How the same events take place and again. But in the New Testament, there's this mixture. So you get elements from the Old Testament mixed up with Buddhist ideas.
So you've chanced upon as much as anything because of your background and prior
that
studies
is correct.
A new exegesis.
Yes, that is correct. It was simply, it came like that. And the one of the main Buddhist texts was discovered in the 30s in Kashmir. And it was then published in Italy. Now it's, God knows what happens to the Sanskrit text. They're no more available. I have a suspicion that those people in Rome sought to it to remove it. I don't know. But anyhow, it was available then. In libraries, it still is available. So I saw we're dealing with translations.
So Simon Peter, the first pope of Rome, the rock upon which the church is founded, is not a rock, not a foundational rock at all.
That's
something
correct.
Very different.
That's correct. And as for the relative chronology, let there be no doubt. Already in the 3rd century BC Buddhist text, the Buddha is walking from village to village, exactly like Jesus. And he comes to a village where there are some priests. And then one priest asks him, "Who are you?" And then the Buddha, take note of that, he says, "I am the God of gods and I am the King of kings." If you look at the Greek numismatics, you'll find that in the Hellenistic period, these terms occur, the King of Kings and the Savior.
But you, in your book, you say that there was a Buddhist mythology, which is very disconnecting of cause and effect and quite irrational, that was proposed as a sort of popular philosophy and superimposed upon what was, in fact, a very rigorous
that's right
understanding of Greek geometry and
right Daniel. But to finish this line there, then this the priest asked the Buddha, "Okay, so you're the King of Kings and the God of Gods, but who's going to succeed you?" "My successor will be Shariputras, the first of my 12 and there you have the foundation of the Christian church, because Jesus is saying, "You will be my successor, you will be the foundation of the church." And eventually then we have the myth of Simon Petrus, that was the Buddhist Shariputras, becoming the first imaginary mythical pope. And this, one day, very soon, in China, there are about 100 new Sanskrit scholars every year. It's just a question of time before they look at what this strange man from Denmark is saying, and they can verify.
And so, and they can lift the skirt up of our irrationality as
well. The first step, let's take one step at a time. The first step is that, well, there seems to be good evidence that this first pope, Simon Peter, is in fact the Buddhist Shariputras. That's the first step. And if they have the resources with the mass media and so on, they will be quite smart, and they will talk how are we to handle this issue. I had Chinese students coming here, so I do know the Chinese people. They gave me some Sanskrit manuscripts many years ago. I know how they think. So that'll be very interesting for these people, and Japanese scholars likewise. How are we to handle this issue? I haven't thought that far yet. Yeah. I would just say that this is a yes.
You've provided some clues though,
in
the golden ratio and so forth.
That is right. Next question is, what about Buddhism? Now, scholars usually, and I grew up with that too, I've been in the business for more than 40 years with Buddhist studies, and I wrote the textbooks that Danish schools are using. Okay, standard work. Next question is, scholars usually say that the Buddha, he lived in the 6th or 5th century BC. Everybody says so. Now, as it happened, after I had figured out that the New Testament, thanks to a Dutch scholar, let his name be mentioned, Smit Sebinga. He spoke at a theological conference in 1970 in Leuven, and he said, it's very important, he said, as far as the Gospel of Matthew is concerned, my research has shown that Matthew carefully counted the number of syllables and words in such a way that his text was symmetrically arranged. That is, it could be divided a given unit or pericope, as theologians say. Jesus' new chapter, for instance, Jesus in the morning, he did so-and-so, wondered so-and-so, and here then, so story, new story comes up. Then invariably, there will be, say, 100 words or 200 words or a round number of words and a number of syllables in a given ratio, like 2 to 5. Say 100 words, 250. Always these simple ratios, with the golden ratio being the most common. So these people, Professor Smit Sebinga, established this thesis. Very interesting. You can read hardly anything about it. He published in Dutch publishing house Brill in Leiden. DW will know this publishing house, very well known. And I wasn't present, this was in 1970, but I spoke to the professor of, it's really worth, for the record, in Lund University of New Testament Studies, Gerhard Gerhardsson, when I was on good terms with him. And he told me, yes, I was present, he said. And do you know, Dr. Linda, how the colleagues, famous theological professors, reacted when Smit Sebinga presented his paper? They giggled. Giggled. I said, there's no reason for giggle. It struck me as lightning, I must say, because this was very, you can certainly see the perspective, that these people who wrote the New Testament were counting syllables and words, which means that it's a highly sophisticated text that they wrote. It's an artificial text. Okay, that is a fact. It simply cannot be denied. But theologians today do not want to hear this. Right. Only the other day when I was in Aarhus University, I spoke to Professor Dr. Alphonse Fürst of Münster University, holding a double doctorate, partly in Greek philosophy and partly in Catholic theology. And I said to him, are you aware, Professor Fürst, that the New Testament is written by people who carefully counted the number of syllables and the number of words in such a way that the number of words and syllables are combined according to, above all, the golden ratio and other ratios such as 1 to 2, 1 to 3, always these basic simple ratios. Then he looked at me and said, no, it can't be true. It's not true. You don't write text like that. I asked him, why? How can you be sure? No, people don't do that. Please, two of your own colleagues, Professor Smit Sebinga and Professor Menken, have established this, that the texts are symmetrically arranged. No, I won't hear that, he says. And he was a highly competent professor, Alphonse Fürst, University of Münster, doctor of classics and doctor of Catholic theology. So he's saying, like Cremonini to Galileo, Galileo, I don't want to see it. And that is typical, typical. We don't want to see this anyhow. So once I had noticed this, thanks to Dr. Smit Sebinga, who called my attention, and I continued my own studies and verified he's right. It's most amazing. I asked myself, what about the Buddhist text? And then I started looking in the Buddhist text, and they showed exactly the same geometrical patterns in such a way that only Greek geometricians, mathematicians, could have created them.
So they're the ones who are borrowing, and they're the ones
So I come to the conclusion that the earliest Buddhist texts were made by geometricians. And who are Greek geometricians who at the same time are interested in philosophy and theology? There's only one answer, Pythagoreans. Hmm. For them, theology and geometry are the same thing.
Brilliant.
Perhaps even Orphos. But to be on the safe side, Pythagoras. So I'm saying then that since the earliest Buddhist texts must have been created by Greek geometricians, it can only have happened after Alexander the Great, who left India in 325.
There's a bust of Pythagoras in the Vatican. Did you know that?
Yes, I know on coins and busts, but what is in particular do you have in mind, J.W.?
No, I was just saying whether there's knowledge, a wider knowledge that perhaps cannot be, this is a sort of Dan Brown thought, really, isn't it? But, I mean, you've discovered something which has existed for a long time, which, yeah. Let's say, was created intentionally. It could only have been created intentionally if you're... two professors are correct about that, and let's assume that they have to be because they wouldn't go public unless they were sure of their facts. Yeah. So we can rely on the fact that these are religious texts which can be produced in the light of, let's say, certain kinds of knowledge which you're going back to possibly Pythagorean or even Egyptian times. I don't know, but I mean, gets all wrapped up in all kinds of crazy beliefs if you do that. What happens to religious thinking when religious texts as such are so esoteric? What happens to religious feeling? What happens to the expression of faith when, in actual fact, we're only talking about an artificial medium that is presented for people's belief? I'm not saying that artificial mediums are not what people believe in. I'm just saying that this would be a rather, unless you provide inroads from the exoteric into the esoteric, unless you provide routes, so you would have to have schools that people with questions can actually move from the outer circle and into the inner circle where this sacred information is available, then what you have is a completely discrete or a recondite source of knowledge written once and long forgotten, and everything else is simply darkness and error, confusion, irrationality. So the question really which follows from your discovery and from the discovery of the two professors who you named earlier is, were such schools ever available? Are they traceable in the historical record?
I would trace them to the Pythagoreans, as said, who did make a very sharp distinction.
Yeah, you're tracing it back in that way, but what I'm talking about is it would have to be applicable at the time the New Testament was written.
Right, and it is.
Otherwise, there would
followed.
Be no point. Yes, I mean it's the Greeks. If Greeks wrote the New Testament in this form, then they wrote it for the reason that they wanted, or at least Matthew. In this form, that they wrote it for the reason that they wanted to preserve knowledge in this body of work, and there is no point, none whatever, in secreting knowledge away in that form, unless there is a possibility in life for those who contact the outer circle, the writings themselves, to penetrate to the esoteric core. So where do we look for those media? Now, in Islam, oddly enough, you have an inner circle, which is Sufism. But as far as I'm aware, there is no such inner circle in Christianity, nor ever was there.
Okay. The Pythagoreans make the distinction, which goes on later on, namely between the akousmatikoi, the outsiders who just listen, and the insiders, the mathematikoi, the mathematicians. And this distinction between insiders and outsiders is explicit in Buddhist texts, where we also have a Sanskrit term for those who are akousmatikoi, listeners, it's shravakas. When you come then to the New Testament, there are some very significant passages. Fourth chapter of Mark, where Jesus says, there's something called the mysteries of the kingdom of the heavens. It is given to you, my closest followers, to know it, but those that are outside, it is not given to them. So here you have the insiders as opposed to the outsiders, for sure, in the very words of Jesus himself. And he uses the term mystery, the mystery of the kingdom, given to you, but not to them.
But don't we have here the basis of a very rational kind of reverence, if not religion, of Europeans, which is obfuscated by that which is presented to the listeners, and with this sort of crazy mythology that's been imposed on it, and is given us as a legacy, this sort of strange obsequiousness, which would have us surrender our very people and culture.
Precisely. And the answer could be given in using terms the ancients themselves used, like the Varro, the scholar. He says there are three kinds of theology, and this is very important, three kinds of theology. The real philosophical theology, which has to do with numbers and physics. And then the mythical or poetical, and that is what we hear in the church, that is the stories. And then the ritual or practical aspect, that would be the rituals like baptism and the supper, right? So you have this threefold, but among the Lutherans, the threefold distinction has been forgotten. And that means we would have been a laughingstock of the ancient theologians who were very careful to make the threefold distinction. And there's a wonderful place in Cicero's wonderful books on the nature of the gods, where one of Cicero's friends, who's an augur, a priest, he says that it's a great how when one augur meets another, he can withhold laughter. And he says, I don't believe, of course, in the myths of the poets, he says, this priest, but I insist, even though the gods do not exist, I do insist on our having this part of theology we call the ritual theology. That would mean simply the churches as we have them today in England and in Denmark and in Germany, even though they are empty, that is, even though the faith is empty, even though these gods do not exist, they serve a social purpose. That was one of the general ideas of educated Romans and Greeks.
So this could be very important to
indeed.
Not only respecting ourselves but defending ourselves. This could be
very clear.
Really
and you know, everybody's got the book. That is really hilarious. I've said this to Danish priests. I've said, please don't believe what I say. Go home and count. Start with the first sentence in Matthew. You'll see wonderful mathematics. Wonderful.
In Greek. It was written in Greek.
Of course in Greek. But all theologians from a university, whoever
Greek.
University degree, can read the Greek. And they're all indexes, concordances, grammars. It's the easiest thing. In fact, you can... Jehovah's Witness will supply you with an excellent Greek text and a word-for-word on English.
I'd never get rid of them, thanks.
Well,
they
don't
you.
Keep on coming when you ask them to read the Greek. They don't come anymore.
Right, okay. Remember that one.
Yes. And just to give you one example.
They came to me yesterday and I read them Dr. Littner's book. I really do. True story.
You see, one simple thing. You start with a line, one, a unit. Once you've got a right angle triangle, one, and then you get the square, one plus one, and then you get the square root, which is 1414, right?
14, 4, that's a good name for number for white nationalists.
Okay, good. 14. Let that then be the radius in a circle. This means that the diameter is 282.8. That makes a circle circumference 888. You multiply 2.828. by 3.14. So you have the circle 888. That is the number when you spell Jesus in Greek, because the Greeks didn't have numbers. They used letters for numbers. So J is 10, eta, number two letter is 8, S is 200, O, the Greek spelling, is 70, U is 400, and then S is 200.
Okay.
888. That adds up to 888. Okay. So you have the 888 circle. And that is, for any Greek schoolboy, would immediately see this. Good. So now you can start. The inscribed square, if the circle is 888, is 800 precise. And then you can easily find also the inscribed triangle, it's 735, the inscribed heptagon, hexagon, octagon, and so on. Each of these corresponds to the basic titles of Jesus as King, as Lord, as Only Begotten, as King of the Jews, each of them.
Amazing.
Amazing. And for anyone to check for himself.
But this is still not providing what I would recognize, and which you would from your studies of Buddhism, as being a religious pursuit in any way. It's informational and rather dead. That's what I find. Perhaps
because that brings us back to the Greek philosophers. And as you remember, what was the inscription above the entrance door to Plato's academy? Mm. Let no one enter without geometry. right? And this, as for me personally, the more I think about it, the more liberating it is. Like the Pythagoreans did say that you have to create geometry in your soul. What does that mean? It's quite right. It is the true philosophy, really, because that means you create order and harmony. And that is what we are looking for.
That makes sense.
And that is what we are looking for. The more you study geometry in this ancient Greek way, the more you get you develop your sense of harmony and beauty
and judgment.
And order.
It would seem a part of aesthetic judgment too, very fundamental.
Sure. And this is very different from certain decadent forms of modern art where the ugly and lack of harmony is in the focus. We don't have to mention any names of rich and famous artists with strange names who earn millions on producing ugly pieces of art. So really, now we are coming really to the future of Europe, and that is we start with getting harmony and beauty and order and reason in our souls. That is the only answer. And that will, of course, only be a real minority, not a majority. Right. And without that intellectual class, the aristocracy of virtue and talent, to use Jefferson's word, there's no hope for this globe. But the only way is this: create harmony and beauty in the soul through geometry. And so these ancient texts work on two levels. The mythical, intended to attract people to go deeper into studies of geometry. It's easy to verify. Plutarch, well-known Greek author, has this story about Apollo, the sun god. He posed geometrical puzzles because he wanted the Greeks to study geometry. So this is really the idea. And as you know, the Parthenon is a magnificent example in stone of harmony and of geometry. And you can find hundreds of examples of the golden ratio being applied in the construction. So that is the only way I come now. Born in 49, and this is where I am today. It is with this ideal, and this ideal unfolds itself of the Pythagoreans in the four virtues, of course, which again is harmony, that is science, justice, courage, and balance, sophrosyne. That is my ultimate answer to today's problems.
Four is a magic number, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is, but all of them are, but never in themselves. Always this harmony, and always reducible to circles and to spheres. Yeah.
Okay, I can see a principle.
Yeah.
How would you bring that together with your own knowledge of Buddhist practice, meditative practice, if you like? How would you find this highly intellectual and aristocratic, Platonic ideal,
right,
relating to the notion in my terms, which I use a lot, of the movement from human absence to human presence? I tend to look upon this as a semi-Heideggerian. I come really from that perspective. And to me, you know, this is a really human affair. It's about it's about putting your hands into the soil and making them dirty. It's about feeling life. So I can see that there's a harmony required there, and I can see that that harmony is central to human presence. But what I don't see is that it is directly relatable to specific mathematics. It's something which I can talk about in words and through perhaps if I had somebody appropriate to talk to in person and through demonstration, but I could never get to it through talking about the beauty of mathematics. So I'm just wondering how these two, what we can call a Heideggerian idea, something to do with human being, and this rather cool and beautiful and intellectual system that you're talking about can come together.
Which affords pleasure and harmony and well-being, undoubtedly. I feel well, I go to bed, I sleep immediately. Often, unfortunately, I have dreams about Socrates. It worked very well.
Well, I wouldn't want to dream about Socrates either, I'm sure. You remind me of one of those Buddhist monks. You know, you seem to have discovered some sort of secret which you're very pleased about. But, you know, we look on from the outside. Certainly, I look on from the outside, you know, and I see your round tummy and your beaming smile. And I look at this man and I say, well, he's got something, but for the life of me, I can't see what. I can't speak Greek, for one thing, and I'm not a mathematician.
They were very smart, these Pythagoreans, and a wonderful sense of humor. They were very smart guys, very, very smart. Take the word harmony, for instance. Harmonia. Look at this number. You get the number as usual, A-R-M-O-N-I-A. That adds up to 272.
Yeah.
Now divide by the golden ratio, which is 1618. You get 1681. This means that they even created words on the basis of mathematics.
Right.
So it's so far-reaching.
They produced a system of relatedness for words and ideas.
Yes. Relatedness, fine. Yes. Yes. Based on mathematics.
That would be a highly esoteric study. It would require anybody to start with to have a pretty good IQ. I mean, just to handle philosophical ideas, to think in the abstract, to move ideas about, to weigh them and judge them, connect them, you've got to have an IQ of about 124. That's probably 124 in ancient Greece might have been quite an ask. To get to the level of a Oxbridge professor is 130 plus. To get to the level of original thought, the capacity to think originally, is about 138. To win a Nobel Prize, the average for Nobel Prize winners is about 142. And so you go up. Now, I mean, you know, to put together a system like this is definitely Nobel country. And even to get into it and to have everything involved is probably well in advance of 124. So you're talking about an elite of the highest order. And what I'm interested in, as somebody with, you know, the political outlook, really is how to deal with the masses of our numbers.
Yes.
How to provide a basis for them to live in a true way, true to themselves.
Yeah, right.
So to discover in themselves their own natural interests, their own their own right, which nature gives them to live on this earth. Yes.
And Christianity doesn't help.
Christianity does not help, because Christianity comes with a Hebraic idea that one is the other and not oneself. It takes
we're, as you say, these undifferentiated Gentiles.
Not therefore having its own unique and true meaning and value. And this is precisely where we have to get to, because we've had 1,500 years of exploring, you know, our own lack of specificity and worth.
But there is a geometry of Europe, is there not? And I think that there's an imbalance to the European geometry in America that accounts for part of the problems that they're having.
Yeah, yeah. We would be moving toward Plato, who certainly was a Pythagorean philosopher, and we would be talking about a class society along the lines of the Republic of Plato. That's Pythagorean. Pythagorean. And you know, the caste system in India, actually, as far as I can see, it also comes after Alexander. And I read the caste system as a copy of Plato's...
You're talking about the creation of a, you know, at the top of the pyramid, of a small elite who have duties to the rest. But
yes, definitely.
But we Europeans, I have to tell you, we Europeans have a profound, and you've already spoken about the 68ers, but we have a profound sense of the individual and of what is fair. And this is something to do, in the opinion of a lot of people in our part of the world ideologically, is something to do with the emergence of European peoples in cold climate circumstances, these small groups who are struggling. You know, the land couldn't support large numbers like you got in the Fertile Crescent. Small groups who are struggling in very difficult circumstances who evolved a high value for the life of the individual and who did not tolerate, you know, attacks on that value. It appears in liberalism. But you know, that is something which we cannot abrogate as Europeans. I think we're stuck with that. And you know, this idea of a Pythagorean or Platonic elite or a Brahmin elite, whose, you know, function it is to minister to the, you know, to the rest of, that would bring out the 68er in me, that's for sure.
I didn't sense much of the 68 in you till now.
No, but you've got it now.
But to begin, if we're to encompass this individualism that's inherent to us as Europeans, wouldn't we begin to propose that this, of course, couldn't exist if the boundaries were and the borders were let go forever, and therefore try to popularize what's called paradigmatic conservatism, that is, conservative borders and relatively free and liberal individualism within the borders for Europe.
You'd have to come up with something like that, because, I mean, you know, a system that is founded principally on harmony cannot have a world in which there is total flow and churning. You know, that's not conceivable. You could not generate it. So it's a very conservative vision. It would commend
at
social conservatism at all levels. At all levels.
Between levels.
Yeah,
but not necessarily within.
But what it needs
within there could be a great deal of freedom.
But what it needs is for Christian to study the way in which such a philosophy would effect, you know, not
but see, in
any detail, but just in the fundamental principles.
We're going to catch flack for this, and it's a good time to come back to something that's nagging at me, and that is Jews were not so influential on Marxism. My experience of academics in America is I think actually that Jews are very influential, and there's not only the Jewish influence, but there's something that we're calling Jew thinking, that is the residual logic of meaning and action, or even
of
rebellion against the logic of meaning and action that could characterize, say, the Nazis. It's sort of like a mirror image of Jews, or the Stalinist who were still acting in accordance with Jewish instigation, like the cricket with the worm in it, and just being driven insane by a Jewish logic of meaning and action. And I see Christianity is quite Jewish as well in its liberalism and in its universalism that's applied to us as the undifferentiated other. And this is all border-wrecking stuff. And so I do see a Jewish hand there I see Jews as, we're not monocausalists at Majority Rights, but I think that we recognize, we can't turn away from the fact that they seem to have a profound influence in seven control point niches.
Yeah.
So one of them is religion, academia is another, finance is another, media is another, and as Bowery says, the Bible was one of the first Jewish media hegemonies. Another would be business, and the other one is law. And with these laws in Europe, these hate laws, this is certainly very Jewish stuff. Now you have liberal Europeans, yeah, but they're conditioned by this other Jew thinking as well. So we want to be sovereign. There's a difference between sovereignty and having a design to annihilate people. And so it is important, I think, to take into account this Jewish influence and in Bolshevism too. So if we're not going to take flack at Majority Rights for no other reason, but
Christian's been in America, so he's well aware that there's a completely different relationship of Jewry towards political power in America than applies here. There is obviously a relationship in Europe, and it is powerful, but in America it's overbearingly so. And one should always
bear in mind.
Yes, of course. And that's one of the reasons, that and the fact that there's an awful lot of German Americans in the very small world of nationalism in America.
And Irish.
Why it's so anti-Semitic in America. And we don't have the same anti-Semitism, generally speaking, in ethnic nationalisms here.
Oh, no.
There was only
Hitler.
Well, no, he wasn't. I mean, when you look at those guys with those lovely uniforms, parading around with their special marches, what they're really telling the world is, I too am a Jew. I too am racially superior. This is me being my best. I am dressed up in this special clothes, and this takes me out of my tawdry experience as a spotty German youth. And I have
Dr.
now...
Dr. Littner thinks that there's this Jewish acting in this chutzpah of the Holocaust denial. Too.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, it always looked very suspicious to me the way these guys were, you know, even Martin Heidegger put on a goddamn uniform, and only for a little while because he was thrown out of the party. But the readying.
You see that as an affectation.
It as a total affectation, and I'm sure Heidegger must have seen it too. I mean, if the man sorted out the fact that living with technology takes us into a kind of a being that is less than authentic, well, certainly living living the life of a uniformed soldier as you go about and the university and talking to your professors, certainly that he must have felt that was somewhat inauthentic, I would.
I almost forgot when listening to you there. Of course, yes, I have experienced the situation with the Jews in the United States. And of course, yes, surely they have a lot to say in the universities and so on. But my general impression, too, is that they are sort of often Luftmensch, that there's not much substance. They make a lot of noise and a lot of trouble.
Yes.
But in the long run, where is the substance in all this?
Okay, to be brutally clear, the Jewish struggle for eternal supremacy over the Gentile, but really the European host, is a response, a normal evolutionary response to environment. It is precisely the same struggle against nature's hostility that Europeans have undertaken, and the Han Chinese, the great races of the cold climate north, is precisely the same as that. Only the inhospitable environment is the European host, and they are evolved by selection to pursue evolutionary strategies, which include this crazy idea, actually, but anyway, this crazy idea that they picked up way back when, 2,600 years ago. And now we're talking really about Ashkenazic Jews who probably weren't anything to do with the people who were in the Bible in Moses' time. For some people, it's an issue which they would characterize as being sort of parasitic in nature, and I don't particularly want to indulge in that. I think that it's quite sufficient for us to talk about it in evolutionary psychological terms. And what that does is it frees us to say, well, now we can understand what this is. We can understand that its nature is supremacy through debilitation. So it doesn't require substance. It only requires the ability to mislead, to confuse, to deny, cause division. So we can see that in Marxism. We can see division through class warfare. We can see it in cultural Marxism that followed. It's a standard thing. It's not difficult to actually identify it. Say, well, that's it. That's why there's no substance. You wouldn't expect it. And they are evolved for high verbal IQ, not necessarily high analytic IQ. That's another factor that's relevant to this.
Great. When I was a director at the Institute of Oriental Studies in Copenhagen, I suggest we certainly need a professorship of Jewish of the study of the Jewish problem. You would have stood a good chance of getting that
probably
position.
Yeah. Well, I think the man who stands the best chance of that is Kevin MacDonald. So I mean, that's already been done, and I'm only really
he has done very good work. What I suggested to him, to Kevin, when I talked to him about this, I also think he does a very good work, is to consider using the term envy as a motive from the Jewish side. The Jewish women want to be Nordic blondes, if you look at Jewish, et cetera.
Yeah.
And that is really what I have experienced too, you know, envy.
It's probably narcissistic and narcissistic to say so, but, you know, African women straighten their hair.
Yeah, that's right.
There is this tendency for non-Europeans to select European females. And, you know, it's just one of
and
those
I
things.
Mean, some of the best German scholars were Jews, Edward Norton and so on. I mean, they admire. I've seen that every time. And if you can't reach the higher levels, then envy comes in.
Yeah,
it's very clear. Did you know? But we won't take that up today. But the other thing is that the business with the Old Testament, as one rabbi quite clearly has honestly said about the Jewish Kabbalah, it's from the Pythagoreans, he said. And
yeah,
he's right.
It's numbers, yes.
Yes, it is. And Moses is not that old, you know. Are you familiar with the motive of the theft of the Greeks?
No.
Have you heard this idea?
No. Go on.
Perhaps in the first century BC, Jews like Philo developed a very strange idea. That is, the Greeks are wise, and the Greek philosophers are wise, but they stole it all from Moses.
Right.
That's important. And the early Christians like Origen, of whom I spoke previously, took that idea over. The first of the philosophers was Moses, and Plato, he copied Moses. And it's so founded in the Christian church.
That's a new one on me. I hadn't heard that before.
I heard it from these Jehovah's Witnesses. They were saying that Aristotle got all his ideas from the Bible.
Well, that's an echo of this idea.
Yeah.
And in the church, we don't hear Plato mentioned. We hear David and Moses. Very important. So perhaps we can also fix that up a little bit and correct some of these ancient errors that are so widespread.
GW and I agree that the Christianity is a big problem. It's a central problem.
Well, the beautiful thing would be to have some real knowledge of what preceded it, and a real understanding of what preceded it, because that was the natural expression of the European religious soul. It was stamped out so completely that we're left just with a few Rhine maidens and what have you, and Eddas that were written much, much, much later in Iceland. And it's pathetic how little is really left of that, what must have been a huge Northern European tradition of faith, completely gone. To have been able to go back and study it, to have found real threads of it, would be terrific for us. Not because we're religious in any way, but because we are students of our own people and of what is real in us rather than what has been created for us in the modern world, which does not provide for us the conditions necessary for life. And that's the essence of the nationalist complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Daniel, are you content?
I'm content. I want to thank Dr. Lintner very much for this conversation.
Second that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really... It's a pleasure to talk with somebody who knows the subject so deeply and so well. It's a pleasure.
This is very, very important information he's imparting.
I still don't understand it. I'm still not a mathematician, and I would never be part of the elite.
You also didn't read his book yet.
I haven't got it yet. No, don't worry.
You're doing a great work, the two of you. Thank you very much for doing that in an unselfish fashion.
No, but I don't think that's true. No, never let anybody call me unselfish. Thanks very much, Christian.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye, then.